It's like asking a car insurance company to pay for your damages while you're not paying premiums.
Reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that allows employees to opt out of union dues. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the first tribe to come out against the Donlin mine marches in Bethel.
We see the development of Donlin as a threat to the subsistence of our river.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Citing the proposed Pebble Mine, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency wants to rein in his agency's regulatory power. In a sweeping memo released today, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt asked the agency to propose changes to how it uses the Clean Water Act. The proposal would eliminate EPA's ability to preemptively or retroactively veto permits for waste discharge in waterways. Under the Obama administration, EPA used that authority to propose restrictions on the Pebble Mine before the developer applied for a permit. That essentially halted the project until last year when EPA reached a settlement with Pebble under the Trump administration. In the memo, Pruitt says he's concerned that EPA's Clean Water Act veto power, quote, could influence investment decisions and chill economic growth, end quote. Pebble Mine opponents immediately condemned the memo. A spokesperson for the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation says his organization is very disappointed by the news, adding this has not been an authority that has been misused in the past. But a spokesperson for the Pebble Mine praised the memo, saying it would allow a full, fair, and rigorous environmental review. A U.S. Supreme Court decision released today dealt a blow to public sector unions that will have big implications in Alaska, which has one of the highest rates of unionization in the country. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that employees of state and local governments who opt out of union membership won't have to pay union dues. It was the result of a challenge by a state employee in Illinois who argued he shouldn't have to contribute to a union he didn't agree with. To force him otherwise, he successfully argued, violated his First Amendment rights.
It's a great day for Alaska and a great day for public employees.
Jeremy Price is the director of the Alaska chapter of Americans for Prosperity, an activist group funded and founded by the conservative billionaire Koch brothers.
For the first time in decades, the Supreme Court recognized the First Amendment rights of public employees. So starting today, going forward, government workers are no longer forced to pay for collective bargaining and political activity as a condition of their employment.
The ruling affects state and local government workers who are covered by a collective bargaining contract. That's about 10% of Alaska's workforce. Before the ruling, state and local workers covered by a contract negotiated by a union had union dues automatically deducted from their paycheck. That will now end. The Supreme Court's decision means workers can opt out of paying anything, but they'll still work under the contract negotiated by the union on their behalf.
It's like asking a car insurance company to pay for your damages while you're not paying premiums.
Abel Bolito heads the union that represents about 1,200 faculty within the University of Alaska system. About 20% of eligible faculty aren't union members. After today, they won't have to contribute to the union's finances. But Bolito says his union will step up its game to respond to the Supreme Court ruling.
It's politically motivated. It's very unfortunate, but I believe that we as a union will be stronger because the members will realize how important we are, and the union leadership will no longer take membership for granted.
The state's largest public sector union, ASEA, had been bracing for this change for about 2 years, says Executive Director Jake Metcalf.
I don't buy that it's doom and gloom. In fact, I say bring it on.
He says the union has been making its case directly to state workers that it's in their best interest to stand with their union. Only members can vote when contracts are sent to the rank and file for ratification.
They're not going to be better off by opting out. In fact, they're going to, you know, lose out on their ability to participate in that negotiation process and have their opinion be heard. So, you know, we're going to educate the members on that. And with a contract coming up for most of our members at the state of Alaska, it's a really important time to be part of the membership.
State economists will be watching for the ruling's effects on the economy. Dan Robinson, research chief of the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, says short-term effects are unclear.
One of the things we'll watch for, though, is what happens to wages. For example, less collective bargaining tends to mean lower wages. But that's one of the data elements we'll watch.
On the political side, Governor Bill Walker released a statement hours after the ruling expressing his disappointment with the conservative majority's decision. But he says he's, quote, confident that public employee unions will remain the backbone of Alaska. The Oruchagamute Native Council marched against the proposed Donlin gold mine on Friday. ONC is the first tribe in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to publicly demonstrate against the project, which would be one of the biggest gold mines in the world. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports in Bethel.
Protect our land! Protect our land!
The Oruchagamute Native Council, or ONC, held their first public demonstration against the proposed Donlin gold mine. The large gold mine would be built in a region where many residents practice subsistence, and it's located on a tributary north of Crooked Creek, which is on the Middle Kuskokwim River.
Subsistence way of life is too important, and the Kuskokwim River provides us with food, and the Donlin gold mine is not the place to have it here on the Kuskokwim.
That's Ivan Waska, an elder who marched with ONC against Donlin. He joined 30 other marchers from the tribe and Bethel community who want to protect the fish from what they say are the dangerous impacts of the proposed gold mine. ONC is the first tribal governing body to march against the project in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The Chelista Corporation and the Kuskokwim Corporation, or TKC, have come out in support of the mine. Chelista owns the subsurface rights to the land where the mine would be built, while TKC owns the surface rights. ONC has voiced concerns through public comment for the mine for a couple of years, but plans to protest fell by the wayside with the death of its natural resource development director, Greg Rozitska, last year. Peter Yvonne is ONC's executive director, and he says the mine's possible risks outweigh any potential benefits.
This thing's getting pretty far down the road already. Obviously, jobs are important for the region, and I think there's a risk that we should take of any kind. In my mind, a short-term positive.
The proposed mine would increase barge traffic on the Kuskokwim River, which is the source of the YK Delta's subsistence activities. Salmon and smelt, a smaller fish that comes in the late spring, could be significantly impacted as well by all that traffic. Other concerns include the impact on water quality and possible air pollution from mercury released from rocks during mining operations. But Donlin has touted the job growth it could bring to the region and has held multiple public hearings on the project as it goes through the permitting process. Donlin spokesman Kurt Parkin says the company has worked very closely with Chelista and TKC to develop the mine responsibly. But individual tribes may not agree with the positions of those corporations. And Parkin says that's expected.
That's a tough question to answer because I think that it's not possible to get unanimous support on any subject in favor of something or against something.
Walter Jim is the president of ONC's board. He didn't attend the march, but he says that his tribe's responsibility is to protect its lifestyle from any threats, even if that threat could bring some economic relief.
With me, my belief is that every tribe's priority responsibility is to protect their tribe. And part of those protections is the subsistence way of life, and we see the development of Donlin as a threat to the subsistence of our river.
Jim says they are reaching out to other tribes along the Kuskokwim to join in the fight against Donlin. He says there will be more demonstrations down the road, but when those will be is unclear. Meanwhile, Donlin is plugging through the permits it needs to start the mine. The company says it expects to get most of its major federal and state permits out of the way this year. Army Corps of Engineers is expected to roll out its joint record of decision on the project in mid-August. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Draft recommendations are coming together that could shape Alaska's climate change policy in the future. Governor Bill Walker's Climate Change Task Force has been working this summer to nail down some clear objectives. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
The draft climate plan already includes statements on reducing carbon emissions and diversifying the economy, but task force member Mark Misteller encouraged the group to add another one, a policy statement on science education addressing climate change.
This affects everybody, right? So that's why I felt it needed to be its own policy statement.
Misteller says the task force is still working out the details of what the sixth policy statement might mean. So far, they've come up with some broad suggestions, like strengthening research at the university system and adopting a statewide plan to increase science education in K-12 schools. Misteller compares this approach to another campaign, anti-smoking.
You know, without an education about the impacts of smoking, we wouldn't be able to take action as quick. So, you know, the general education and awareness of the problem or the issue is kind of fundamental to all the other things in the plan.
The task force will be holding their next in-person meeting in Anchorage in August, and they're hoping to present the plan to the governor by September. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to understand how a warmer Bering Sea affects marine life.
There are a lot of unanswered, very fundamental questions about how fast some of the early young stages of fishes and other critters are growing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
In a surprising move, the Anchorage Assembly voted down a proposal to raise taxes on cannabis businesses. During a meeting last night, more than a dozen people from the local industry spoke against the proposed tax increase. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the testimony swayed the vote.
2 years ago, voters in Anchorage gave the Assembly the ability to increase taxes on the new industry incrementally up to 12%. That's on top of the taxes collected by the state. On the table was the first bump from the current 5% rate up to 7%. No one from the public spoke in favor of that change. Susan Noland owns a retail cannabis shop in downtown Anchorage and told the Assembly the industry is still in its infancy and struggling to get its financial footing. Noland and others want more time before paying higher taxes on sales.
I believe in taxation. It's good for the industry, but I think it's too soon right now. Give us a chance.
The mayor's administration had hoped the tax increase would help boost revenue to the city above the $1.3 million it brought in last year, helping to shift a small portion of the municipal budget off of property owners. But opponents say cannabis retailers in Anchorage are already paying several times more in taxes than it costs the municipality to regulate and monitor their operations, and that it would be harmful to add more costs to new businesses as they're still trying to get on their feet. The discussion scrambled the Assembly's normal ideological splits.
Clearly, the industry has already paid for its cost.
Assemblymember Amy Domboski is a fiscal and social conservative who usually votes against measures favorable to the cannabis industry, but she came out forcefully on behalf of businesses in opposing the tax increase.
I don't believe the administration has demonstrated a need, nor do I think they have been the best stewards of taxpayer money. Therefore, I will not vote to give them more of it.
The overwhelming 8-2 vote against the proposal was unexpected by even those from the industry. Cannabis remains expensive to grow and sell in Alaska relative to other states that have legalized. However, the tax rate on retailers in Anchorage is not outside the normal range of other hub cities, falling above Portland on the low end, but lower than Seattle on the high end in the overall tax burden. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Anchorage Assembly also approved a change in how it clears unlawful campsites in the area around public parks and trails. In what could be a dramatic change in enforcement, Assembly members unanimously voted for a more aggressive policy that designates broad zones where camps have to be vacated along a faster timeline. The move is meant to address vocal and increasingly organized complaints from property owners that the city does not do enough to clear out large, sprawling campsites scattered throughout the parks and greenbelts. The Assembly will provide campers 72 hours to leave areas that fall into the new prohibited zone category. Those include public lands near parks, trails, schools, and other civic infrastructure. In those instances, the municipality will store people's belongings in a city-run facility if they request it. Up until now, the policy on the books targeted individual campsites for cleanup, which critics say just pushes the problem from spot to spot instead of expelling unlawful encampments. In Sitka, like many towns in southeast Alaska, geographic isolation creates unique problems for affordable housing and homelessness. This week, Sitka held a pair of town hall meetings with a visiting expert to look for ideas for solutions. KCAW's Rachel Cassandra reports.
Affordable housing has long been a concern in Sitka, and so has the connected issue of homelessness. Recently, a national report called Out of Reach quantified the gap in Sitka between a livable wage and the average wage. Brian Wilson, executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, says almost half of Sitkans may be struggling to make rent.
If you look at the Alaska numbers, they calculated that an individual would have to make $24.80 an hour in order to afford a fair market two-bedroom rental. And this is problematic because they also calculate down to the community level how much an average renter is currently making per hour. So in Sitka, 44% of our households here are rentals, and the average renter is only making $13.96 an hour.
Wilson says this wide gap means Sitkans may not be able to afford other necessities besides rent and utilities. But the problem is not unique to Sitka. Out of Reach identifies no county in the U.S. where the local minimum wage affordably covers rent for a two-bedroom apartment. About 55 Sitkans total attended the town hall meetings at the Sitka Public Library. Participants brainstormed homelessness actions. They included creating camping shelters and weaving sleeping bags and mats out of plastic bags. Carly Collins, who spent the last 5 years homeless, says it's important to live independently in a home, even if it's very small and mobile.
A couple of good ideas that I heard was a tiny house on wheels. There's not a lot of, like land availability to actually park a tiny house on wheels. But the campgrounds in town, you know, you can only stay for a few months. Somebody did just bring up the idea of taking abandoned boats and you know, double checking, making sure they're all right, and then having that as an accessible way for people who are homeless to have some kind of shelter, independent shelter of their own.
Sitkan Gail Young is active in the struggle against homelessness. She is part of the Sitka Homeless Coalition, which hopes to build an overnight winter shelter. Last year, the coalition partnered with the First Presbyterian Church, but those plans came to a halt when the church announced it was closing. Now the group is continuing its search elsewhere.
And we're looking now for a space. We're ready for a space. We would love to get these guys undercover this fall. If they choose, it's just an option.
Wilson warns, however, that shelters are a last chance resort to address homelessness. He says that the issues need to be addressed on a systemic level and that preventing homelessness is better than providing shelters. Reporting in Sitka with help from Tina Bachmeyer, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Excursion Inlet's fish processing plant is gearing up for another season. Recently, seafood processor and distributor Ocean Beauty had been reducing its canning operations while ramping up frozen fish production. This new direction has brought in more business for the Excursion Inlet plant. KHNS's Henry Leisha took a tour to see how it has been changing.
When Ocean Beauty's Southeast Operations Manager, Mike Forbush, started coming up to Excursion Inlet about 30 years ago, the cannery mostly employed college students, but that's not the case anymore.
I would be very young on this crew, and I'm almost 50, so I would say the average age is probably closer to 50, 55.
The vast majority of the staff are from the lower 48. Employees have been spreading the word about the plant to family and friends from New Mexico, Yakima, and Stockton. Forbush says there's about a 95% return rate for maintenance workers, which has all but eliminated the need for outreach.
We've recruited in Juneau, we've recruited in Anchorage, and we get very, very few people. And I think last time we recruited in Juneau, we picked up one person.
By now, multiple generations have worked at this plant. Some are part of families that have been coming since the 1940s. There's a lot of work to be done on the canning machines. The plant relies on models from the 1960s, and there aren't any companies that produce salmon canning machines anymore.
Because there's just not enough canneries to, there's a lot of soup canneries and things like that, but not a lot of salmon canneries.
Maintaining this equipment requires skilled machinists who can make parts on the spot. But for all of the work that goes into this assembly line, a small fraction of the product will end up in a can. For the last 2 years, Ocean Beauty has been placing more emphasis on freezing fish in Southeast Alaska. Forbush estimates that 85% of the fish processed by the plant this year will be frozen. There are a few reasons for this. The majority of Ocean Beauty's canning in Southeast Alaska revolves around pink salmon. Other species of salmon are not as cost-effective for canning. But the pink run is looking weaker this year, especially for the northern part of the region. In addition, the market for frozen fish is much more lucrative right now. Forbush says a lot of Excursion Inlet's frozen fish is being sold to other processors in countries like Germany and France. Some of their fish is being sent to Ocean Beauty's plants in Washington.
And then we have quite a big smoking operation down south, and we'll send quite a bit down to be smoked. We do all our cold smoke in Monroe and our hot smoke in Renton.
Ocean Beauty's Petersburg plant did not operate last year due to a lack of freezer facilities. This resulted in Excursion Inlet processing around 26 million pounds of fish in 2017. That's three times as much fish as it processed the previous year, which is good news for the Haynesboro. The plant brought in over $300,000 in raw fish tax revenue. Recently, the borough helped pay to replace a failing bridge that supports a waterline for the Ocean Beauty plant. At a dedication for the new bridge, Forbush said that the repair ensured the plant would keep running.
There'd be no way the cannery would operate. We have no source down below with enough gravity feed to get to the cannery. It would have been disastrous for us.
The Petersburg cannery will remain closed again this year, and the Excursion Inlet plant is preparing for more frozen fish production. In April, they bought a new compressor for the refrigeration system. The last time they had updated the refrigerator was in 1979. Now the plant will be able to freeze fish 24 hours a day over a three-week period. Excursion Inlet's plant superintendent Tom Marshall says they aim to process around 20 million pounds of fish this season. In Excursion Inlet, I'm Henry Leisha.
The Bering Sea is getting warmer, and in western Alaska, there is a lot less sea ice. But there's not much known about how this affects marine life. As KNOM's Gabe Colombo reports, scientists are trying to figure some of those details out.
So we're out there for the second year. We had a nearly identical cruise last year.
Seth Danielson is a University of Alaska Fairbanks oceanographer. He studies the ocean. And for the past two summers, he's been leading a team of about 20 scientists aboard the research vessel Sekuliak as they study the spring transition in the Bering and Chukchi Seas.
If you're an ice algae that grows when the sun comes back in the springtime, And all of a sudden, the amount of time that you have to do your thing is shortened by a month. How does that impact you as a community or your role in the greater ecosystem?
The project's title is a mouthful, Arctic Shelf Growth, Advection, Respiration, and Deposition Rate Experiments. But Danielson says the acronym Asgard is actually a perfect nickname.
Because if you remember your Norse mythology, Asgard is the homeland of the gods, and it's the most productive. And here we are in the Bering Strait region, a really remarkable continental shelf, because it gets perhaps the biggest flux of nutrients of any intercontinental shelf in the whole world.
That's because the currents through the strait are like a big balancing act for the world's oceans. Excess fresh water from the North Pacific, which has a lot of nutrients, comes up into the Arctic Ocean and then across into the North Atlantic, which is much saltier. Of course, a lot of scientists come to study the Bering Strait in the summer, but Danielson says this project is unique because they're here a lot earlier in the year.
There are a lot of unanswered, very fundamental questions about how fast some of the early young stages of fishes and other critters are growing. And by being out here at this time of year, we can start to get a better handle on some of that.
To answer those questions, the Asgard crew is taking a bunch of measurements over several years. Water temperature and salinity, wind and current speeds, solar radiation. They also capture a whole range of small organisms like plankton and take observations about larger ones like fish and marine mammals. This summer, the team observed 5 dead seabirds, which was more than expected, but not quite as many as last year. And Danielson says while the ocean's surface was cooler in some places and warmer in others, the sea floor was actually a few degrees cooler than last year. So the story's not black and white.
If you were to page back through the last decade or so, you'd see that the Northern Bering Sea is one of the places in the globe that really hasn't changed that much. Like, there's been this basically marine heat wave for a long time, probably since about 2013 or 2014.
But Danielson says nobody really knows how that heat wave will continue to develop and affect the Bering and Chukchi Sea ecosystems. So the Asgard crew will be sifting through all the data and little marine organisms they've collected for years, trying to decipher the hidden messages of the sea. Reporting in Nome, I'm Gabe Colombo.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Christy Schellenberger in Bethel, Rachel Cassandra in Sitka, Henry Leisha in Excursion Inlet, and Gabe Colombo in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message is sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.